think we're gonna go ahead and get started. It looks like it's 2 minutes after four. I want to begin with a brief paragraph from a book I'm reading. You've heard Eugene Peterson's name mentioned a couple of times this week already. And he has a really nice autobiography called The Pastor. And he just talks about his vocation to be a pastor and a congregation's vocation to live as a community of faith, a certain people in a certain place, and how grace-filled, potentially grace-filled and beautiful that can be. And he asks this question in a chapter entitled Eucharistic Hospitality. Come on, me too. He asks, is it possible to live in this increasingly inhospitable world in a hospitable way? Is it possible to do something focused and intentional about what is wrong in our society without turning the wrongdoers into the enemy? Gathering friends and family to the table for a meal is our most frequent act of hospitality. Coming to the table where Christ is the host is hospitality at its most complete, receiving the Christ and the entire creation and community of Christ in thanksgiving. When we leave that table, any table, we are blessed, predisposed to engage in hospitable life. Those tables are located in specific places with specific communities of people at specific particular times. And those places, people, tables, the buildings that surround them are under a whole lot of stress right now. And I think we'll spend a little time talking about that today. After Ellen's Bible study this morning, I was talking to Jan, and she commented to me, it seems so clear to me here, but what happens when I go back home? Where we go back home is to those specific places and people and times. Economy and ecology were described as related. Both also relate to the ecumene, the church, and all those words come from oikos, the Greek for household, the household of God. The church is a household of God. At its best, it lives for the world. Is it possible for the oikos, the household of God, also to serve the ecology and the economy? That's what I want to think about with you today. I start out with a little bit of personal statement. I spoke about this at more length yesterday in my session. I love the church. In so many ways, the church made me who I am, gave me my wife, and sheltered and formed my life and my family. But I hate the church as well. The church has the potential to be redemptive in this world. It also has the potential to be demonic. And I think a good bit about what the Christian life in community is about is trying to find ways to foster that redemptive potential within a particular people, a particular place, and a particular time. Churches often fall prey to the typical idols of religion. Staff with doctorates, big, beautiful buildings, great sound systems, and all that kind of stuff. I want to say that today, too little can be as much of an occasion for sin as can too much. So part of the question I'm asking today is about the oikos, the household of God. Can these bones live? Alan talked about change, and I think he used four C's. Do you remember this morning the four C's he talked about? Anybody?
Conviction
was one.
Conversion.
Confession came next.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and then, pardon me? Contrition. And compassion. Yeah, remember those? I want to add one more C, community. I think people are changed by community as well, which is another reason why the household of God and the particular communities in which people live are so important to me. How do Christian communities respond under the pressure of not enough? Let me ask you, what are the experiences of scarcity in your life? And not just in your church community. I know some of you might come from big booming suburban churches, really healthy places that don't seem to have a lot of scarcity. But I suspect all of us experience scarcity in some ways in our life. Anybody?
I have an example. So I'm the president of a community of Lutherans and Catholics in Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And we have a part-time pastor and a part-time Catholic lay leader. And our part-time pastor, who's the lead minister, is out on medical leave because she's battling stage 3 breast cancer.
Uh-huh.
So that's what that's why you're talking to her, I feel like.
Okay. So you're dealing with a shortage of people.
Shortage of people.
Leadership,
and
resources.
And also, yeah, our spiritual leader is out now, so that's really affecting the whole community.
There's a vacuum at the center. Yeah. Others? Yeah.
I am the chancellor of the Episcopal Cathedral of St. John in Providence, Rhode Island, and we suspended our services semi-permanently on April the 22nd because the physical costs to rehabilitate the building were in the $16 million range. We've got a congregation of 200 people, most of whom are immigrants from Liberia and Nigeria, and I think our average family pledge was someplace in the nature of $250 a year.
It takes a while to get to $16 million at that rate, huh?
A little hard.
So the church is no longer worshiping.
Church is no longer worshiping. Got a new bishop coming in November. We're waiting to see whether he's going to turn it into a concert hall or tell us to tear it down.
Oof. What is a chancellor? I don't know.
I'm
that.
The chief legal officer of the diocese.
Thank you. Okay. Good. That helps. Other folks?
Well, I volunteer at a food shelf in Minneapolis, area. And scarcity of donations. Here it is summer. Kids are not in school, therefore dependent more on meals at home, yet our shelves are there. And our funds are low. And interestingly, we can, for every $1 of cash donated, we can purchase the equivalent of $7 of donated items.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not only do we not have food available to give, or very limited amounts, but our ability to purchase at more cost effectiveness is way down as well because of donations.
Scarcity of time and available attention, part of the local blues dance scene in Vancouver, BC, and we run largely because it's something that we all enjoy doing, and so as a result, it is a full-time job, or even a part-time job, or for most of us, even a paying job. It is not, and so when we're trying to get something off the ground in our spare time, and we're all a busy bunch, how do you do what needs to be done, and to distribute things in a way that we can still have the events that we want to have, the dances that we want to have, etc., even when, you know, half of us happen to be far too busy to actually do anything.
Right. Time is one that we're all, I think, well, you know, finally mortality stops the clock for everybody. So how much time do we have, and how can we use that resource? Other thoughts?
I see scarcity. Almost every day when I drive by the homeless shelter 2 blocks from my house.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the men, and then now they've opened up a women's component. So the line of men are on one side, and the smaller line of women are on the other side of the church. And I see that very much, the scarcity of resources, the problem with resource allocation.
And does your church do anything with that shelter?
No, with that shelter. Our church is working to create, we're working with an organization right now that's working on combating unaccompanied adult homelessness, like older teens, youth.
Right.
And we're looking, United is on the western side of Minneapolis, and so United Community Lutheran is looking towards creating a similar program in the western side of the city.
In my workplace, I've been dealing with scarcity of kind of vision and competence for making things better, but a kind of an abundance of dissatisfaction.
And you got that.
No. The employees have it. It's
okay.
Kind of a, it's an interesting dynamic between the leadership and the staff. And I mean, the general employees who often have a better sense of how they would like things to be, but don't really know how to get there.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's all about money.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably not true, but it's a kind of sense of what, I mean, but can't even imagine what the skills are needed to advance.
Money is a resource, but it's also, something that is a symptom. And can be symptomatic of deeper things that are going on. Anybody else?
So I grew up with a single mom, three daughters, and she had bipolar. So she had uncontrolled spending problems. So although she made enough working as a community developer, we didn't have enough because of her. If we had an excess one month, she would buy new dishes. If we had an excess, she would buy, you know, things that in the long run, it's good to have clothes, but being presentable was really important, and having nutritious food a little less important.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a bad allocation of resources
mm-hmm.
on her part.
Imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
Scarcity of resources in our public schools is that the states cut funding and borrow from the school to balance the budget. And so we have classes that are 30 plus students in a class. And just,
and now when kids are quote unquote pulled out of the classroom, whether they're gifted or ESL or learning disabilities, they're being tutored in the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
Or under the stairs
mm-hmm.
because there's nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they can only have a 15-minute recess because of all of the logistics of getting kids in and out of the lunchroom
yeah.
in the most efficient way. And you know, and they have music once a week, they have art once a week, they have gym once a week instead of, you know, when we grew up it was two or three or sometimes five times a week. So the other thing I was going to mention, the tension of scarcity in our congregation right now is, and anyone else here from our church can chime in, but we are in the midst of a capital campaign. We are a congregation is blessed with an abundance of resources in all different ways, including financial. And we are in the midst, we're a small congregation, but basically 600 members.
We'll get back to that.
Yeah. by Minneapolis standards.
Yes. Okay.
But by Minneapolis Midwestern standards, middle class standards, we don't have enough space.
Uh-huh.
By white middle class standards, we don't have enough space.
Gotcha.
And so so it's not being able to be in the sanctuary, not having to have good sense of. So we went through a 2 years of churn around what's the right way to spend our resources because we have a very strong mission around serving the poor.
Uh-huh.
And so is it right to invest in building more brick and mortar that will create a space for more people to feel welcome to this good news, which is an inclusive, progressive, Holden-like place? Or is it better to continue to sacrifice and be physically uncomfortable, maybe, or inconvenienced in order to be able to use more of our resources towards really directly serving the poor? support. And, you know, we kind of, we landed on that we needed to create a welcoming place for more people who are primarily under church, de-churched, who think the church is no longer for them and don't know about this kind of message, about the good news, that we need to create more space because they won't come if it feels too crowded. They won't come if it's too dated. They won't come if the carpeting is worn. And that's a way of creating welcome. So it's been a really, and we're trying to do the not so big house approach to this, but it's still a $3 million project.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a long thing, but that's a tension and scarcity and abundance in our congregation.
I'm going to get to you in just 1 second, I promise. How many of you go to congregations that average less than 250 on Sunday morning? How many of you go to congregations?
On a Sunday morning.
A Sunday, yeah.
That one's just yes.
Okay. The mainline less than 50% rule. Okay, there we go. How many of you go to congregations that average less than 100 on Sunday morning? A couple? Okay. The United Methodist Church, the median size of congregation is about 50. My tradition, the median size is about 70 right now. There are... And I'm curious, I mean, I don't know how many of you are from small rural type churches. Anybody? Are we all urban, suburban, that kind of setting? There's a whole raft of small churches in rural areas that might average anywhere from 8 to 30 on a Sunday morning. Lots and lots of congregations of that size. So that's why I laughed when he said 600. And some of the rest of us maybe also. Those are different critters. Okay.
Yeah, I'm a member of a finance committee at a Portland church that is struggling. And we're having deficits in the $10,000 to $20,000 per year. And that's with interim pastors that are co-pastoring at a three-quarter time level. And so if we were to go back to a full-time pastor, we would probably be having another $10,000 of deficit. We're lucky, lucky in quotes, to have a foundation board, pretty well endowed, but the foundation board is a group of people who have taken it on themselves to just protect that foundation, those assets.
Sure.
They're of the belief that they should not spend any of that money that they control for the general operating budget of the church.
Yeah.
So we could conceivably have a church go out of business and have a foundation and a building, and all of that would just go back to, you know, to the Senate. So, and it's set up this them and us. It's really weird. I mean, they'll pay for us to put a new bike rack in, because a new bike rack isn't part of our operating budget, and we're in bad shape. I don't know how it's going to shake out. But I think the foundations are, from the experience that I've seen,
it depends. But what you describe happens rather commonly and becomes a problem. Or another version of that is, a friend of mine was a pastor of a church that got a big bequest, but it was a designated bequest to build a bell tower and do some other particular goofy thing that didn't help the church at all. So sometimes, you know, money comes with strings, or people attach strings to it that you may think you have resources, but it's pretty restricted. Well, yesterday I talked, I'm going to move on, I think, actually, it's time to move on. I talked yesterday really briefly about Ronald Heifetz, who has a really, I think, powerfully done book called Leadership Without Easy Answers. It's in the library if you want to look it up. I was saying that I meet with a group of seminary professors who teach leadership. We meet once a year, and it's the craziest mix of people I've ever been a part of. They come from all ends of the theological and ecclesial spectrum. I never anywhere in my life get together with the kind of breadth of folks that meets in this group. All of them use this book to work with ministry students. And it has some really helpful distinctions. And this is one of them. This is not rocket science, but it's really helpful just to fix this in mind. Heifetz talks about two different kinds of challenges. One of them is a technical challenge. And what he means by that is that's something we know how to deal with. Broken arm, go to the doctor. Flat tire, fix it. Stuff like that. And the other kind, however, is the stuff that's a little more puzzling. Adaptive is what he calls that. And let's see if I get this right. Okay, there's the technical stuff. And then one more piece is that we often rely on experts to help us fix things like this. Adaptive stuff. We don't know the answer. We don't even really know the right question. Sometimes it's a matter of the values we have that don't mesh with reality. So the folks who are guiding the use of that endowment, you know, they have a certain set of values. Preserve. Money is to be stacked. You know, that kind of contrast. Other people think money is round to roll and spent. Okay, so you got values in conflict with the needs of an institution. They're not being used. Or the values themselves are in conflict, spend or save. And in an adaptive situation, you got to make some changes or things are going to go away. Something is going to happen that is finally destructive of the structures of community. If you haven't heard it yet, let me say it really clearly. I am an institutional thinker. Institutions frequently go bad, and in our culture they have a terrible, terrible rep. So we think about the institutional church, trash. You know, that's the thing that does bad stuff. Unfortunately, institutional structures are the things that hold communities and values together over time. You don't go into a value-driven organization and have it last without it developing institutional processes, structures, their habits, organizational habits that guide what we do and make it easier for us to get by every day. And so, you know, I think institutions are critical to the church. It's not that institutions should be rejected and you know, the institutional church is bad. We need to make our institutions better. That's what needs to happen, not just throw them out. Because if we ignore them, if we think we can't deal with institutions, what is going to happen is we're going to develop some other bad institutions. So the point is, how do we make the institutions serve the values and mission of the organization and community? The key kicker for adaptive pieces, besides the kind of sense of struggling in the dark, is that something is going to be lost. Someone is going to lose something dear to them. When values come into conflict, you know, you got to make a choice eventually if this community, this institution that holds it is going to survive. So, are they going to tear down that building? Are they going to fund it so you can serve a populace, or are they going to turn it into a concert hall and do a little fundraising for the diocese? Somebody's going to lose. All right, and this is just a kind of really helpful distinction when you're dealing with difficult stuff. One more thing about the adaptive challenge. I mentioned being in the dark. When we face the great unknown, when we don't even have a clue about where to go or what the next steps are, it makes us anxious. And the threat of change makes us fearful. And the certainty of loss really scares us. What that does is it narrows our sense of vision, reduces the amount of options that we can see, our sense of what's possible for us. We begin to respond instinctively. We fight. All these kinds of things grow out of the kind of pressure of being challenged with this sort of challenge. Ministry in the face of those kinds of adaptive challenges, in the face of scarcity, is tough because of that. So, to make the last point, people act differently when they're under these circumstances. You're going to see that. Here's a kind of interesting story. Theologian named Langdon Gilkey, somebody I studied with in divinity school a long time ago, wrote a book called Shantung Compound. And in this book, he describes his experience and reflects on his experience during World War II. He graduated from Harvard in 1939 and decided to do something like a gap year that we're talking about here at Holden. He went to China to teach English, and the Japanese invaded. And in the course of their sweeping through China, they gathered up all the Westerners who were in their path and put them in basically concentration camps. They weren't as bad as the European concentration camps, but people were brought together, there was shortage, there was difficulty. These folks at Shantung Compound, interestingly enough, mostly they were religious workers. There were some well-educated educators, lots of ministers, lots of missionaries, Roman Catholic nuns, but mostly Western Christians who were brought together into this camp, Shantung Compound. And he wants to talk about one thing that happened in December of 1944. There are 1,450 prisoners in the camp. Food is tight. In 1943, the Red Cross was able to ship parcels of food to the camp, and enough so that it supplemented people's diets for about 4 months, as long as they rationed that food carefully. Even so, by 1944 in December, Gilkey said that his weight had dropped from 170 to 125 pounds. Food was short, things were tough. So you have these 1,450 prisoners, and in the daily ration by the time they got to that December date was 6 slices of bread, some boiled water, a cup of stew for lunch, and a bowl of thin soup for supper. So you can see why you would be losing weight. That's the opposite of the kind of eating we're doing here, but that's what they were dealing with. But Gilkey describes the wealth that it meant if you got one of those food parcels and got extra food. It was really, really wealth. He said it made its possessor an astoundingly rich man. Well, you got 200 Americans in this group of prisoners, and in the winter of 1944, well, let's see, 1,550 Red Cross parcels arrived at the camp from the American Red Cross. And
for Americans or for?
Well, there we are. Here's the question. How do religious people allocate scarce resources? Okay. Should you give one box to all 1,450 prisoners? You got 100 left over. You could then give the Americans each another half box. That's one option. Or you could give 7.5 boxes to each of the 200 Americans. How about that? Unfortunately, some of the Americans said to the other nationals, "Why doesn't your Red Cross take care of you? This is American food." And you can imagine the reaction in the community when that happened. People began to mutter. There were fist fights in the barracks where there had not been any before. The Japanese officer who was in charge of the camp had all the parcels piled in a great heap in the camp's church. Is this great or what? The parcels were piled in a heap in the church while he tried to figure out what to do. This was a problem for him as well as for the prisoners. People were really bitter and fighting. And finally, word came down from the commander. The parcels were to be distributed, one per person, with the Americans receiving an extra half box apiece. And when that decision was made by the camp commander, the sense of relief in the camp was palpable. People were elated. It was just like Christmas. They knew they now had food to get them through to spring. So the next morning, people lined up to receive their parcels at the center of the camp. And a soldier walked up and tacked a notice on the notice board that said this: due to protests from the American community, parcels will not be distributed today as announced. Signed, the Commandant. Seven Americans had complained that American food was only for American prisoners. So once again, the distribution was halted while the matter was referred from the camp commander up the chain to Tokyo for a decision. The next 10 days were even worse, as you might imagine. National pride and fist fights occurred. And all during the wait, Gilkey says, the massive mounds of life-giving parcels lay inert at the center of the camp, while gusts of human conflict and ill will swirled turbulently around them. Some of the best-intentioned Americans tried to convince their resistant compatriots to change their mind and give in, but self-interest and righteousness trumped every attempt. So, what we are looking at now is the specter of no parcels at all. How do we allocate scarce resources? What's the outcome? That which was once life-giving food now has turned from blessing into curse. The community has been destroyed by division over who should get what. An unmitigated blessing has been turned by selfishness into a curse. And as Gilkey concludes, here was evidence before my eyes that wealth and progress can have demonic consequences. Wow. That puts it there. So how does the story turn out? Well, ironically, of course, the word from Tokyo was that everybody in the camp would get a box, including the Americans. Sounds good so far. But the rest of them got sent to a different camp. So what happens here? The demand for more resulted in fact getting less. It's an interesting comment that he makes that even an enemy authority can mediate the divine justice in human affairs. That's great. That story has lots of implications about how Christians live together in community ourselves with resources, and you've described a lot of the kinds of tensions and challenges that emerge in churches, in families, in workplaces over these kinds of things. Gilkey actually pulls up one more funny moment that I think is worth noting. From Bertolt Brecht's Three Penny Opera, even saintly folk will act like sinners unless they have their customary dinners. People act differently under the pressure of allocating scarce resources. Or, as noted theologian Gary Larson puts it, I don't know if you can see that. God in his kitchen with a little jerk shaker he's about to shake on top of the earth. Just to make it interesting. Well, I think that it is possible for us to mitigate those demonic potentials and to actually increase the odds, perhaps to 52%, of more redemptive things happening within communities and organizations. I see faithful, creative, and innovative leadership happening in many places where there isn't enough, despite the fact that there seems not to be enough. And so I want to try to describe today some challenges of scarcity, and also some gifts that it brings. And then if we have time, think a little bit about some proposals that might be of use. Challenges that you think of, you've named a lot of things in terms of various contexts. Here's some that I've been thinking of. We inherit things that ought to seem good, like the food, but in reality, they're quite ambiguous. That endowment that your church has is ambiguous. You've got leadership in your, is it a workplace?
Yeah.
That, you know, is functioning in an ambiguous way. They may help, but they might not. The things we inherit aren't always what they seem to be. You got a lot of people coming to that church, and you have the resources to make new space, and it raises issues and challenges for the church to deal with. These are the kinds of, you got a great building. Mm-hmm. How much is it going to cost to repair that building?
Millions.
Yeah. And the congregation can't afford it. We inherit things that are that seem like unmitigated blessings, but they turn out to be quite ambiguous, and they can become curses. We have all sorts of external expectations that we have to deal with. Sometimes even the expectations that come upon us are a burden. So, let's see. How many, you know, churches put crosses out front? Usually. Well, okay, cross out front. People see that, they think, help. The church where I served in a pretty poor area on the south side of Chicago was about a block from a nursing home that had been into a facility that housed but did not supervise people who were somewhat mentally ill. And those folks would come out for walks and see the cross, and they would head right to the church building. We did not have the resources to help them. There were frequent requests for help that we simply couldn't meet. We didn't have the resources. But those expectations are there, and you want to do something. Christians want to help. And when we can't help, it drives us nuts. Frustrating is a mild word for it, isn't it? A third challenge, the limitations are real. There's simply not much you can do without your leader there to help. And there's no way that you're in a position to say, be gone, we're going to bring somebody else in. But without your leader there, there's a vacuum, and it's really tough. Those are real limitations. We have lots of great ideas that we simply can't bring to fruition. The pace of change is different. We might see things that we want to deal with and change, but we simply are short enough on resources that we can hardly get through the day. You were going to raise a comment?
Yes. However, continue the slide, and I will raise it at the end.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Because I was thinking about your situation is that.
Yes. However, I was actually going to play a little bit of a double design advocate around three. The flip side of that is that while limitations do keep you from carrying out many good ideas, they also force you at times to actually produce more interesting ideas because you have to work within a particular constraint. Problem is when that constraint gets too tight that you can't function, as opposed to when you have just enough of a constraint that says, okay, well, we can't do A, but maybe we can do A prime, and that's close enough to B that we might be able to see what comes out.
Yeah, you're ahead of me, which is fine. I will, yeah, that's a great point. So we'll get to that and throw a few twists on in addition. My fifth challenge is that staff people just get eaten up. People with responsibility, leaders all across the board get eaten up with this constant burden of not having enough or having to deal with enough but in the wrong place. All those kinds of questions are really tough, and that does cause people to just throw up their hands and finally say, I can't do this anymore, and go somewhere else. Your employees were frustrated in that situation. Another challenge of scarcity is that it really means you don't have fat. There's not a lot of space for anything but the urgent, so you are constantly feeling like you're dealing with the next demand, and you never have a chance to get, Heifetz uses the language of get on the balcony and get a larger pattern picture. You just can't do that. Urgency is getting. Multiple overwhelming needs demand incredible focus. You know the notion of triage? There are really two competing understandings of triage. Hospital emergency room is the first one. You know, the person with the gravest need takes priority. And so that's why people who come in with a broken arm might sit for 6 hours before they get attention. The gravest need is dealt with first. Battlefield version of triage is more calculating. It would say, we are going to ignore those whom we can't really help, and we will attend to those who have the best chance of longer-term survival. So that frequently means you leave people to die by the side of the road. This would be a really difficult study to put side by side with the story of the Good Samaritan. Lots of times in organizations that are dealing with urgency and scarcity, you are attending to the gravest need, and even being able to get to that other one. What are the best long-term chances for change? You know, let's not talk about the battlefield, but let's say, what's the best way that our organization can make progress so that 10 years from now, the community is healthy and sustainable? If that means ignoring some of the pressing needs of the moment and some of the people who feel those needs, can we do that? These are really difficult things, and they wear folks down. I will talk about experimentation in a moment as one of the ways in which we can deal with scarcity, but an experiment, you know, sometimes you find something that's successful, but as often you learn from something that fails. When you don't have a lot of slack and you experiment and it fails, you know, it hurts a lot more. So it's just tough. They're extra risky. And then this last one, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow a little bit more. We live in a culture of counting, and we measure success by numbers, income, resources, and so forth. And if those are the perceptions of success all around us, and we're not living with those, we just feel like crap. It makes us question everything about what we do. And I think most troubling to people of good faith and goodwill, it makes us question, has God turned God's back on us? That's really tough. I mean, scarcity becomes a crisis of faith. If we were doing God's will, wouldn't we be blessed and prospered? So those were some of the challenges. We're going to flip the coin. What are some of the gifts? This is, I think, what you're talking about. Crisis can be very clarifying. Good thing in churches, you know, how many times do you hear people who get into church fights over some triviality, some ridiculous thing, colors of curtains or whatever. At its best, crisis removes that possibility. You don't have the chance to argue over trivialities. And it's great to be forced to argue about things that are really close to the heart of faith, rather than superficials. Scarcity can make it harder to deny reality. It's tough to lie about things when, you know, you're about to close your church, or you...
It's tough not to see that one of the homeless men standing there.
Yes. Yes. A third gift. It forces us away from sloppiness and laziness. And again, at its best. Not always. Fourth thing, and this may be going to A prime, the demands are many and varied. They call upon us to use our gifts more fully. A fifth thing is that triage is hard deciding. Another word for that kind of hard deciding is discernment, which is a spiritual practice. How do we discern what is God's will for now, here, with us? A sixth theological point is that scarcity really does bring us closer to the front lines of what it is to be human. And the seventh is related, that vulnerability, dependence, in many ways is the feeling that scarcity elicits in us, and dependence is really how we are before God. We do not earn our salvation. God's grace is a gift, a free gift. And we are totally dependent upon God's grace. And so it oftentimes takes away any kind of idolatrous temptation to think that we can save the world. We can't. But we can do something. Within human communities, trust is absolutely key. And this goes for leaders and followers. When people meet each other's expectations, it builds trust. When people don't meet expectations, trust is eroded. Honesty. You know, again, it's just very easy for people to deny and lie. And it's important to be honest in love, to be able to say, look, this is how it is with me. How is it with you and your soul? When you bring those things together, I think the product is integrity. And that's absolutely critical human quality for living together under stress. Integrity, honesty, love, confidence. Should I stop there? I've got a few more things and I can... Here we go. Creativity costs nothing. I really advocate a culture of experimentation where we not only propose options for meeting challenges, the outcomes of which we do not know, but we propose end times that, at which point we assess and we check in and say, well, how'd that experiment work? And if it didn't work, we honestly and lovingly acknowledge that it didn't work and try something different. That actually builds trust in communities. Failure can build trust in communities much more than denial or obstinacy. And you can have a lot of fun with experimentation. I tell church folks all the time, organizational people, try something. Say you're going to try it for 3 months. Build a culture of trying different things. You know, use different communion bread at Advent than you use during the rest of the year. Try a different way of serving communion during Lent. Lift up different meanings. Sing different words to the same old hymns. Do things so that you build a culture of play and a culture of fun experimentation within an organization. And if it messes up, you know, you say, oh, well, that one really messed up. Let's try something else. That builds a sense of being able to face into adaptive challenges despite not having enough resources. And creativity really is free. It's a great thing to work with. Our church went through some real crises of just in terms of resources and came out the other side with a little bit left over. And people began to say, okay, we've got a homeless shelter in our church now. What else is needed around us in our community, which was pretty poor? And one of the things we knew was that folks could get food at the food pantry, but food pantries hardly ever had fresh vegetables. We also had a lot of gardeners in the congregation who loved to garden. They decided that they were going to tear out a strip of the front lawn of the church, visible location, and get rid of the grass out there and turn it into an organic garden and grow vegetables, which they liked to do. They had fun doing that, and the produce that they grew went to the food pantry for people who didn't get fresh produce. They called it the Garden of Eaton. It was a great thing. We had so much fun with it. You know, people told great stories about it, and it brought a laugh and made folks feel good about what they were up to. So be creative. Celebrate victories, you know, no matter how small. In situations of scarcity where change and the pace of change is very tough, you may only get small victories.
Being creative, one thing that we did in our congregation this year, we needed to, we have a mortgage and that was drawing,
you know, oh, yeah,
up because of interest. So because this calendar year has 53 Sundays rather than the usual 52. They picked one Sunday, this year it was in, I don't remember the date. But anyway, they picked
the week before Palm Sunday.
Oh, yeah. And they just picked a date and called it Miracle on 53rd Sunday.
Okay.
And encourage, you know, it was promoted and built up to that. But on that day, anything that came in the offering, and very intentional offerings, how much can we reduce our mortgage? And it turned out to be a miracle on 53rd Sunday.
That's great. I heard of a church that did the parable of the talents. They basically said, we're going to, on this particular Sunday, we're going to hand out money. You take as much as you need, and you go out and multiply the talents. Come back for some specific purpose like that. There are lots of ways of thinking creatively with resources, and it's really good. It's the one thing you can do, even if you don't have enough counting. Got lots of possible ideas. This fourth thing about proposal for leading is keep your balance. And sometimes, you know, it gets so overwhelming, we've got to get away. I've talked to a few people this week and said, take a sabbatical from church. You didn't hear that? Sometimes we have to have a break, even if it means spending one Sunday or two Sundays in June hiking. Or come into Old Village.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Find ways to keep your balance. Persist. I'm going to be doing the homily Thursday night, and I'm going to talk about endurance, perseverance, persistence. Seems like a small thing. But it isn't. And finally, the last thing I have to say is if you really are dying, you got to go. And you can't. Can't die for the wrong thing. We have 5, 6, 7 minutes or so left. Let's see. And I'm happy to talk for that time around afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. Experimenting, it seems like it takes courage because it is risky. My question is, how many pastors are willing, are wired to take risks? So are most of these experimentations coming up from the congregation as a result of it?
At the very best, there's a kind of really wonderful syncretism that happens and a synergy that is created that people generate ideas back and forth. And if we depend upon our experts, you know, they can't always do it for us. So pastors really do struggle with risk because they have a lot riding on it. How do you mitigate the risk? I really do think this kind of time-limited sense of experimentation is one way of doing it. So one of the things that we got to was rearranging the sanctuary, which, you know, when you mess with the sacred space is always like playing with fire. For good reason. People really care about it. And so it's not a bad thing. But when we messed with the sacred space, we said, we're going to try a different arrangement of the space and we're going to see what it's like. And we really did say, how is it? We gave everybody multiple opportunities. We sought out feedback to try to make sure that everybody got heard. And if certain things that we experimented with didn't work, we really did say, okay, it's done. That was, you know, 6 months there. One of the usual objections, and I'll pick up in just a second, is the argumentation that projects ahead without knowledge. You know, that won't work. I don't want to do that because that won't work. Well, in most cases in organizations, we don't know. The only way we're going to know how something functions is to try it. And if you shut off trying things new, you're dead right there. So I just really think short-term changes, short-term experiments are less risky. They mitigate the risk and they allow people to lose and still save face, and all sorts of good things can happen. I'll get there in a second. Oh,
can I follow up with that?
Yeah, sure.
I'm entering seminary this year, and after hanging out with a bunch of seminarians and discerning that for a couple of years, one of my friends on like an emergent church mission start mentioned that professors were teaching things to students that they have never experienced, but that it was important for living seminarians to understand and know and prepare for that. So maybe it's a generational thing. Like being prepared for the risks and experimenting is part of the future of the church. So it's more integrated into those classes. But you would know because you're teaching it.
Yeah, I didn't tell you, I was a pastor for 18 years before I went to teach. That was 1 year more than I've taught. And so I try to work from that grounding. But yeah, that kind of experimentation is critical.
I just think that idea of a dichotomy, sort of a split between the people kind of below and the leadership and what that looks like. It seems like one thing that's very, very important for the leadership to be very intentional about creating the structure and processes that and the climate that permits that kind of creativity to percolate,
right,
which is pretty, that can be tricky.
Yes.
And then it's also, I think, the leadership creates a ground of identity and being that allows the creativity to come from a source that has some weight and depth. So it's not just going to do whatever. It's
right.
If you feel like it.
You've
got to have sort of a sense of what is it to be an apostolic Christian and a critical mass of folks in the congregation who are connected to that. But it's never going to be everybody.
Right.
So those things are really important.
The discernment piece is what guides that sense of what is appropriate to Christians in this place and time. And Heifetz again talks about creating a holding environment, and that's what you're trying to describe. It's a place where people can be safe to deal with, struggle with, wrestle with those things that they don't know the outcomes of. And he talks about the notion of raising the temperature, lowering the temperature in order to keep it in a productive range. Too much pressure and people just blow up. Too little and they're, you know, comfortable and they don't bother to deal with the issue. So I'd steer you to that book. It's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. A number of years back, I am a member of the Anglican Cathedral downtown Vancouver, and we did a renovation that involved having our building completely closed to the general public for a year. Of course, that was a hard thing given that we're on one of the busiest intersections in the city. What we found when we came back in after having met in the basement of the local library for a year is that the community of Christ Church Cathedral has a ministry. The building that we meet in has a ministry. Those two ministries are sometimes the same. Sometimes they're very different. And figuring out what those ministries were and how to support them and what needs to be supported and whatnot was a very interesting process. And it led to all sorts of interesting thinking that we would have never had we not had to be forced out of our building for a year.
Yeah. Sometimes these things that look like crises really are good things. They really do lead to great potential. They're fun. So, you know, in your situation with your pastor sideline.
That's already happening.
Yeah.
It's we have an amazing steering team, and we have everybody is rising to the occasion. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, I was in a church that was having a roof repair issue. The beams were going like this, and so in order to fix the beams, they had brought in a company that was working on it that they chained across the sanctuary, across the front, to hold the beams together like my thumbs are. And then the company was not doing the work correctly, so they had to do a stop work order and stuff, and they were stuck with these chains in their sanctuary for about 18 months. Well, at Christmas, they wrapped Christmas lights and greenery around them, and they had lots of great lines about throwing off the chains of oppression. It was really great. So, you know, people who, it's the take lemons and make lemonade thing, and doing that in a spiritual context is very rich and does build that kind of, you know, synergistic thing between leaders, followers, pastors, lay people that I think characterizes the church really at its best.
One thing I'm curious about, maybe you can talk at one of your other upcoming talks, is how to deal with people in the community who act out more. And you touched on it in one of your bullets, but act out more in those times, because we also are seeing a lot of that. We have some snipers who are.
Yeah, I'm going to say at this point it's 5 o'clock and
yeah.
You can go.